This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto by Michael Pollan. Read by Scott Brick. Introduction, An Eater's Manifesto. Eat food. Not too much. Mostly plants. That, more or less, is the short answer to the supposedly incredibly complicated and confusing question of what we humans should eat in order to be maximally healthy. I hate to give the game away right here at the beginning of a whole book devoted to the subject, and I'm tempted to complicate matters in the interest of keeping things going for a couple hundred more pages or so. I'll try to resist, but we'll go ahead and add a few more details to flesh out the recommendations. Like, eating a little meat isn't going to kill you, though it might be better approached as a side dish than as a main. And you're always better off eating whole fresh foods rather than processed food products. That's what I mean by the recommendation to eat food, which is not quite as simple as it sounds. For while it used to be that food was all you could eat, today there are thousands of other edible food-like substances in the supermarket. These novel products of food science often come in packages elaborately festooned with health claims, which brings me to another somewhat counterintuitive piece of advice. If you're concerned about your health, you should probably avoid products that make health claims. Why? Because a health claim on a food product is a strong indication it's not really food, and food is what you want to eat. You can see how quickly things can get complicated. I started on this quest to identify a few simple rules about eating after publishing The Omnivore's Dilemma in 2006. Questions of personal health did not take center stage in that book, which was more concerned with the ecological and ethical dimensions of our eating choices. Though I discovered that in most, but not all cases, the best ethical and environmental choices also happen to be the best choices for our health. Very good news indeed. But many readers wanted to know, after they'd spent a few hundred pages following me, following the food chains that feed us, okay, but what should I eat? And now that you've been to the feedlots, the food processing plants, the organic factory farms, and the local farms and ranches, what do you eat? Fair questions, though it does seem to me an index of our present confusion about food that people would feel the need to consult a journalist, or for that matter a nutritionist or doctor or government food pyramid on so basic a question about the conduct of our everyday lives as humans. I mean, what other animal needs professional help in deciding what it should eat? True, as omnivores, creatures that can eat just about anything nature has to offer, and that in fact need to eat a wide variety of different things in order to be healthy, the what to eat question is somewhat more complicated for us than it is for, say, cows. Yet for most of human history, humans have navigated the question without expert advice. To guide us, we had instead culture, which, at least when it comes to food, is really just a fancy word for your mother. What to eat, how much of it to eat, what order in which to eat it, with what and when and with whom, have for most of human history been a set of questions long settled and passed down from parents to children, without a lot of controversy or fuss. But over the last several decades, Mom lost much of her authority over the dinner menu, ceding it to science and food marketers, often an unhealthy alliance of the two, and, to a lesser extent, to the government, with its ever-shifting dietary guidelines, food labeling rules, and perplexing pyramids. Think about it. Most of us no longer eat what our mothers ate as children, or, for that matter, what our mothers fed us as children. This is, historically speaking, a highly unusual state of affairs. My own mother grew up in the 1930s and 1940s eating a lot of traditional Jewish American fare, typical of families who recently emigrated from Russia or Eastern Europe. Stuffed cabbage, organ meats, cheese blintzes, kreplach, knishes stuffed with potato or chicken liver, and vegetables that often were cooked in rendered chicken or duck fat. I never ate any of that stuff as a kid, except when I visited my grandparents. My mother, an excellent and adventurous cook whose own menus were shaped by the cosmopolitan food trends of New York in the 1960s, her influences would have included the 1964 World's Fair, Julia Child and Craig Claiborne, Manhattan restaurant menus of the time, and of course the rising drumbeat of food marketing, served us a rotating menu that each week completed a culinary world tour. Beef bourguignon or beef stroganoff on Monday. Coq au vin or oven-fried chicken in a Kellogg's cornflake crust on Tuesday. Meatloaf or Chinese pepper steak on Wednesday. Yes, there was a lot of beef. Spaghetti pomodoro with Italian sausages on Thursday, and, on her weekend nights off, a Swanson's TV dinner or Chinese takeout. She cooked with Crisco or Wesson oil rather than chicken or duck fat, and used margarine rather than butter because she'd absorbed the nutritional orthodoxy of the time, which held that these more up-to-date fats were better for our health. Oops. Today I don't eat any of that stuff. And neither does my mother, who has moved on, too. Her parents wouldn't recognize the foods we put on the table, except maybe the butter, which is back. Today in America, the culture of food is changing more than once a generation, which is historically unprecedented and dizzying. What is driving such relentless change in the American diet? One force is a $32 billion food marketing machine that thrives on change for its own sake. Another is the constantly shifting ground of nutrition science that, depending on your point of view, is steadily advancing the frontiers of our knowledge about diet and health, or is just changing its mind a lot because it is a flawed science that knows much less than it cares to admit. Part of what drove my grandparents' food culture from the American table was official scientific opinion, which beginning in the 1960s decided that animal fat was a deadly substance. And then there were the food manufacturers, which stood to make very little money from my grandmother's cooking because she was doing so much of it from scratch, including rendering her own cooking fats. Amplifying the latest science, they managed to sell her daughter on the virtues of hydrogenated vegetable oils, the ones that we are now learning may be, well, the deadly substance. Sooner or later, everything solid we've been told about the links between our diet and our health seems to get blown away in the gust of the most recent study. Consider the latest findings. In 2006 came news that a low-fat diet, long believed to protect against cancer, may do no such thing. This from the massive, federally funded Women's Health Initiative, which has also failed to find a link between a low-fat diet and the risk of coronary heart disease. Indeed, the whole nutritional orthodoxy around dietary fat appears to be crumbling, as we will see. In 2005, we learned that dietary fiber might not, as we'd been confidently told for years, help prevent colorectal cancers and heart disease. And then, in the fall of 2006, two prestigious studies on omega-3 fats published at the same time came to strikingly different conclusions. While the National Institutes of Medicine found little conclusive evidence that eating fish would do your heart much good, and might hurt your brain because so much fish is contaminated with mercury, a Harvard study brought the hopeful piece of news that simply by eating a couple of servings of fish each week, or by downing enough fish oil tablets, you could cut your risk of dying from a heart attack by more than a third. It's no wonder that omega-3 fatty acids are poised to become the oat bran of our time, as food scientists rush to micro-encapsulate fish and algae oil and blast it into such formerly all-terrestrial foods as bread and pasta, milk and yogurt and cheese, all of which will soon, you can be sure, spout fishy new health claims. I hope you remember the relevant rule. By now, you're probably feeling the cognitive dissonance of the supermarket shopper or science section reader, as well as some nostalgia for the simplicity and solidity of the first few words of this book. Words I'm still prepared to defend against the shifting winds of nutritional science and food industry marketing, and will. But before I do, it's important to understand how we arrived at our present state of nutritional confusion and anxiety. That is the subject of the first portion of this book, The Age of Nutritionism. The story of how the most basic questions about what to eat ever got so complicated reveals a great deal about the institutional imperatives of the food industry, nutrition science, and journalism. Three parties that stand to gain much from widespread confusion surrounding the most elemental question an omnivore confronts. But humans deciding what to eat without expert guidance, something they have been doing with notable success since coming down out of the trees, is seriously unprofitable if you're a food company, a definite career loser if you're a nutritionist, and just plain boring if you're a newspaper editor or reporter. Or, for that matter, an eater. Who wants to hear yet again that you should eat more fruits and vegetables? And so, like a large gray cloud, a great conspiracy of scientific complexity has gathered around the simplest questions of nutrition, much to the advantage of everyone involved. Except perhaps the ostensible beneficiary of all this nutritional advice. Us, and our health and happiness as eaters. For the most important thing to realize about the campaign to professionalize dietary advice is that it has not made us any healthier. To the contrary, as I argue in part one, most of the nutritional advice we've received over the last half century, and in particular the advice to replace the fats in our diets with carbohydrates, has actually made us less healthy and considerably fatter. My aim in this book is to help us reclaim our health and happiness as eaters. To do this requires an exercise that might at first blush seem superfluous, if not absurd. To offer a defense of food and the eating thereof. That food and eating stand in need of a defense might seem counterintuitive at a time when overnutrition is emerging as a more serious threat to public health than undernutrition. But I contend that most of what we're consuming today is no longer, strictly speaking, food at all, and how we're consuming it, in the car, in front of the TV, and, increasingly, alone, is not really eating, at least not in the sense that civilization has long understood the term. Anthelme Briand-Savarin, the 18th-century gastronomist, drew a useful distinction between the alimentary activity of animals, which feed, and humans who eat or dine, a practice he suggested that owes as much to culture as it does to biology. But if food and eating stand in need of a defense, from whom or what do they need defending? From nutrition science on one side, and from the food industry on the other, and from the needless complications around eating that together they have fostered. As eaters, we find ourselves increasingly in the grip of a nutritional industrial complex, comprised of well-meaning, if error-prone, scientists and food marketers only too eager to exploit the always-moving target of today's nutritional consensus. Together, and with some crucial help from the government, they have constructed an ideology of nutritionism that, among other things, has convinced most of us of three destructive myths. That what matters most is not the food, but the nutrient. That because nutrients are invisible and incomprehensive to everyone but scientists, we need expert help in deciding what to eat. And that the whole purpose of eating is to promote a narrow concept of physical health. Because food, in this view, is foremost about biology, it follows that we must try to eat scientifically. By the nutrient and the number and under the guidance of experts. If such an approach to food doesn't strike you as the least bit strange, that is probably because nutritionist thinking has become so pervasive as to be invisible. We forget that, historically, people have eaten for a great many reasons other than biological necessity. Food is also about pleasure, about community, about family and spirituality, about our relationship to the natural world, and about expressing our identity. As long as humans have been taking meals together, eating has been as much about culture as it has been about biology. That eating should be foremost about bodily health is a relatively new and, I think, destructive idea. Destructive not just of the pleasure of eating, which would be bad enough, but paradoxically of our health as well. Indeed, no people on earth worry more about the health consequences of their food choices than we Americans do. And no people suffer from as many diet-related health problems. We are becoming a nation of orthorexics, people with an unhealthy obsession with healthy eating. Orthorexia, from the Greek ortho, right and correct, plus exia, appetite, equals right appetite. The term was first proposed in 1996 by the American physician Stephen Bratman. Though orthorexia is not yet an eating disorder recognized by the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, academic investigation is underway. The scientists haven't tested the hypothesis yet, but I'm willing to bet that when they do, they'll find an inverse correlation between the amount of time people spend worrying about nutrition and their health and happiness. This is, after all, the implicit lesson of the French paradox, so-called not by the French, quel paradox, but by American nutritionists, who can't fathom how a people who enjoy their food as much as the French do, and blithely eat so many nutrients deemed toxic by nutritionists, could have substantially lower rates of heart disease than we do on our elaborately engineered low-fat diets. Maybe it's time we confronted the American paradox. A notably unhealthy population preoccupied with nutrition and diet and the idea of eating healthily. I don't mean to suggest that all would be well if we could just stop worrying about food or the state of our dietary health. Let them eat Twinkies. There are, in fact, some very good reasons to worry. The rise of nutritionism reflects legitimate concerns that the American diet, which is well on its way to becoming the world's diet, has changed in ways that are making us increasingly sick and fat. 4 of the top 10 causes of death today are chronic diseases with well-established links to diet. Coronary heart disease, diabetes, stroke, and cancer. Yes, the rise to prominence of these chronic diseases is partly due to the fact that we're not dying earlier in life of infectious diseases, but only partly. Even after adjusting for age, many of the so-called diseases of civilization were rare a century ago, and remain rare in places where people don't eat the way we do. I'm speaking, of course, of the elephant in the room whenever we discuss diet and health. The Western diet. This is the subject of the second part of the book, in which I tell the story of the most radical change to the way humans eat since the discovery of agriculture. All of our uncertainties about nutrition should not obscure the plain fact that the chronic diseases that now kill most of us can be traced directly to the industrialization of our food. The rise of highly processed foods and refined grains. The use of chemicals to raise plants and animals in huge monocultures. The superabundance of cheap calories of sugar and fat produced by modern agriculture. And the narrowing of the biological diversity of the human diet to a tiny handful of staple crops, notably wheat, corn, and soy. These changes have given us the Western diet that we take for granted. Lots of processed foods and meat, lots of added fat and sugar, lots of everything, except vegetables, fruits, and whole grains. That such a diet makes people sick and fat, we have known for a long time. Early in the 20th century, an intrepid group of doctors and medical workers stationed overseas observed that wherever in the world people gave up their traditional way of eating and adopted the Western diet, there soon followed a predictable series of Western diseases, including obesity, diabetes, heart diseases, and cancer. They called these the Western diseases, and though the precise causal mechanisms were and remain uncertain, these observers had no doubt these chronic diseases shared a common etiology, the Western diet. What's more, the traditional diets that the new Western foods displaced were strikingly diverse. Various populations thrived on diets that were what we'd call high fat, low fat, or high carb, all meat or all plant. Indeed, there have been traditional diets based on just about any kind of whole food you can imagine. What this suggests is that the human animal is well adapted to a great many different diets. The Western diet, however, is not one of them. Here, then, is a simple but crucial fact about diet and health. Yet, curiously, it is a fact that nutritionism cannot see, probably because it developed in tandem with the industrialization of our food and so takes it for granted. Nutritionism prefers to tinker with the Western diet, adjusting the various nutrients, lowering the fat, boosting the protein, and fortifying processed foods rather than questioning their value in the first place. Nutritionism is, in a sense, the official ideology of the Western diet, and so cannot be expected to raise radical or searching questions about it. But we can. By gaining a firmer grasp on the nature of the Western diet, trying to understand it not only physiologically, but also historically and ecologically, we can begin to develop a different way of thinking about food that might point a path out of our predicament. In doing so, we have two sturdy and strikingly hopeful facts to guide us. First, that humans historically have thrived on a great many different diets. And second, that as we'll see, most of the changes to our food and health caused by the industrialization of our eating can be reversed. Put simply, we can escape the Western diet and its consequences. This is the burden of the third and last section of In Defense of Food. To propose a couple dozen personal rules of eating that are conducive not only to better health, but also to greater pleasure in eating. Two goals that turn out to be mutually reinforcing. These recommendations are a little different from the dietary guidelines you're probably accustomed to. They are not, for example, narrowly prescriptive. Who am I? Who is anyone to tell you what to have for dinner? No. These suggestions are more like eating algorithms, mental devices for thinking through our food choices. Because there is no single answer to the question of what to eat, these guidelines will produce as many different menus as there are people using them. These rules of thumb are also not framed in the vocabulary of nutrition science. This is not because nutrition science has nothing important to teach us. It does, at least when it avoids the pitfalls of reductionism and overconfidence, but because I believe we have as much, if not more, to learn about eating from history and culture and tradition. We are accustomed in all matters having to do with health to assuming science should have the last word, but in the case of eating, other sources of knowledge and ways of knowing can be just as powerful, sometimes more so. And while I inevitably rely on science, even reductionist science, in attempting to understand many questions about food and health, one of my aims in this book is to show the limitations of a strictly scientific understanding of something as richly complex and multifaceted as food. Science has much of value to teach us about food, and perhaps someday scientists will solve the problem of diet, creating the nutritionally perfect meal in a pill. But for now, and the foreseeable future, letting the scientists decide the menu would be a mistake. They simply do not know enough. You may well and rightly wonder, Who am I to tell you how to eat? Here I am advising you to reject the advice of science and industry, and then blithely go on to offer my own advice. So on whose authority do I purport to speak? I speak mainly on the authority of tradition and common sense. Most of what we need to know about how to eat we already know, or once did, until we allowed the nutrition experts and the advertisers to shake our confidence in common sense, tradition, the testimony of our senses, and the wisdom of our mothers. Not that we had much choice in the matter. By the 1980s or so, it had become all but impossible to sustain traditional ways of eating in the face of the industrialization of our food. If you wanted to eat produce grown without synthetic chemicals, or meat raised on pasture without pharmaceuticals, you were out of luck. The supermarket had become the only place to buy food, and real food was rapidly disappearing from its shelves to be replaced by the modern cornucopia of highly processed, food-like products. And because so many of these novelties deliberately lied to our senses with fake sweeteners and flavorings, we could not rely on taste or smell to know what we were eating. Most of my suggestions come down to strategies for escaping the Western diet, but before the resurgence of farmers' markets, the rise of the organic movement, and the renaissance of local agriculture now underway across the country, stepping outside the conventional food system simply was not a realistic option for most people. But today we are entering a post-industrial era of food. For the first time in a generation, it is possible to leave behind the Western diet without having also to leave behind civilization. And the more eaters who vote with their forks for a different kind of food, the more commonplace and accessible such food will become. Among other things, this book is an eater's manifesto, an invitation to join the movement that is renovating our food system in the name of health. Health in the very broadest sense of that word. I doubt the last third of this book could have been written 20 years ago, if only because there would have been no way to eat the way I suggest without going back to the land and growing all your own food. It would have been the manifesto of a crackpot. There was really only one kind of food on the national menu, and that was whatever industry and nutritionism happened to be serving. Not anymore. Eaters have real choices now, and those choices have real consequences for our health and the health of the land and the health of our food culture, all of which, as we will see, are inextricably linked. That anyone should need to write a book advising people to eat food could be taken as a measure of our alienation and confusion. Or we can choose to see it in a more positive light and count ourselves fortunate indeed that there is once again real food for us to eat. Part 1. The Age of Nutritionism. From Foods to Nutrients. If you spent any time at all in a supermarket in the 1980s, you might have noticed something peculiar going on. The food was gradually disappearing from the shelves. Not literally vanishing. I'm not talking about Soviet-style shortages. No. The shelves and refrigerated cases still groaned with packages and boxes and bags of various edibles, more of them landing every year, in fact, but a great many of the traditional supermarket foods were steadily being replaced by nutrients, which, it bears mentioning, are not the same thing. Where once the familiar names of recognizable comestibles, things like eggs or breakfast cereals or snack foods, claimed pride of place on the brightly colored packages crowding the aisles, now new scientific-sounding terms like cholesterol and fiber and saturated fat began rising to large type prominence. More important than mere foods, the presence or absence of these invisible substances was now generally believed to confer health benefits on their eaters. The implicit message was that foods, by comparison, were coarse, old-fashioned and decidedly unscientific things. Who could say what was in them, really? But nutrients, those chemical compounds and minerals in foods that scientists have identified as important to our health, gleamed with the promise of scientific certainty. Eat more of the right ones, fewer of the wrong, and you would live longer, avoid chronic diseases, and lose weight. Nutrients themselves had been around as a concept and a set of words since early in the 19th century. That was when William Prout, an English doctor and chemist, identified the three principal constituents of food, protein, fat, and carbohydrates, that would come to be known as macronutrients. Building on Prout's discovery, Justus von Liebig, the great German scientist credited with founding organic chemistry, added a couple of minerals to the big three and declared that the mystery of animal nutrition, how food turns into flesh and energy, had been solved. This is the very same Liebig who identified the macronutrients in soil, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, known to farmers and gardeners by their periodic table initials, N, P, and K. Liebig claimed that all that plants need to live and grow are these three chemicals, period. As with the plant, so with the animal. In 1842, Liebig proposed a theory of metabolism that explained life strictly in terms of a small handful of chemical nutrients, without recourse to metaphysical forces such as vitalism. Having cracked the mystery of human nutrition, Liebig went on to develop a meat extract, Liebig's extractum carnis, that has come down to us as bouillon, and concocted the first baby formula, consisting of cow's milk, wheat flour, malted flour, and potassium bicarbonate. Liebig, the father of modern nutritional science, had driven food into a corner and forced it to yield its chemical secrets. But the post-Liebig consensus that science now pretty much knew what was going on in food didn't last long. Doctors began to notice that many of the babies fed exclusively on Liebig's formula failed to thrive. Not surprising, given that his preparation lacked any vitamins or several essential fats and amino acids. That Liebig might have overlooked a few little things in food also began to occur to doctors who observed that sailors on long ocean voyages often got sick, even when they had adequate supplies of protein, carbohydrates, and fat. Clearly the chemists were missing something. Some essential ingredients present in the fresh plant foods, like oranges and potatoes, that miraculously cured the sailors. This observation led to the discovery early in the 20th century of the first set of micronutrients, which the Polish biochemist Kazimierz Funk, hearkening back to older vitalist ideas of food, christened vitamines in 1912. Vita for life and amines for organic compounds organized around nitrogen. Vitamins did a lot for the prestige of nutritional science. These special molecules, which at first were isolated from foods and then later synthesized in a laboratory, could cure people of nutritional deficiencies, such as scurvy or beriberi, almost overnight, in a convincing demonstration of reductive chemistry's power. Beginning in the 1920s, vitamins enjoyed a vogue among the middle class, a group not notably afflicted by beriberi or scurvy. But the belief took hold that these magic molecules also promoted growth in children, long life in adults, and, in a phrase of the time, positive health in everyone. And what would negative health be, exactly? Vitamins had brought a kind of glamour to the science of nutrition, and though certain elite segments of the population now began to eat by its expert lights, it really wasn't until late in the 20th century that nutrients began to push food aside in the popular imagination of what it means to eat. No single event marked the shift from eating food to eating nutrients. Although in retrospect, a little noticed political dust-up in Washington in 1977 seems to have helped propel American culture down this unfortunate and dimly lighted path. Responding to reports of an alarming increase in chronic diseases linked to diet, including heart disease, cancer, obesity, and diabetes, the Senate Select Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs, chaired by South Dakota Senator George McGovern, held hearings on the problem in 1976. The committee had been formed in 1968 with a mandate to eliminate malnutrition, and its work had led to the establishment of several important food assistance programs. Endeavoring now to resolve the question of diet and chronic disease in the general population represented a certain amount of mission creep, but all in a good cause to which no one could possibly object. After taking 2 days of testimony on diet and killer diseases, the committee's staff, comprised not of scientists or doctors, but of lawyers and journalists, set to work preparing what it had every reason to assume would be an uncontroversial document called Dietary Goals for the United States. The committee learned that while rates of coronary heart disease had soared in America since World War II, certain other cultures that consumed traditional diets based mostly on plants had strikingly low rates of chronic diseases. Epidemiologists had also observed that in America during the war years, when meat and dairy products were strictly rationed, the rate of heart disease had temporarily plummeted, only to leap upward once the war was over. Beginning in the 1950s, a growing body of scientific opinion held that the consumption of fat and dietary cholesterol, much of which came from meat and dairy products, was responsible for rising rates of heart disease during the 20th century. The lipid hypothesis, as it was called, had already been embraced by the American Heart Association, which in 1961 had begun recommending a prudent diet low in saturated fat and cholesterol from animal products. True, actual proof for the lipid hypothesis was remarkably thin in 1976. It was still very much a hypothesis, but one well on its way to general acceptance. In January 1977, the committee issued a fairly straightforward set of dietary guidelines, calling on Americans to cut down on their consumption of red meat and dairy products. Within weeks, a firestorm of criticism, emanating chiefly from the red meat and dairy industries, engulfed the committee, and Senator McGovern, who had a great many cattle ranchers among his South Dakota constituents, was forced to beat a retreat. The committee's recommendations were hastily rewritten. Plain talk about actual foodstuffs. The committee had advised Americans to actually reduce consumption of meat was replaced by artful compromise. Choose meats, poultry, and fish that will reduce saturated fat intake. Leave aside for now the virtues, if any, of a low meat and or low fat diet, questions to which I will return, and focus for a moment on language. For with these subtle changes in wording, a whole way of thinking about food and health underwent a momentous shift. First, notice that the stark message to eat less of a particular food, in this case meat, had been deep-sixed. Don't look for it ever again in any official U.S. government dietary pronouncement. Say what you will about this or that food, you are not allowed officially to tell people to eat less of it, or the industry in question will have you for lunch. But there is a path around this immovable obstacle, and it was McGovern's staffers who blazed it. Speak no more of foods, only nutrients. Notice how, in the revised guidelines, distinctions between entities as different as beef and chicken and fish have collapsed. These three venerable foods, each representing not just a different species but an entirely different taxonomic class, are now lumped together as mere delivery systems for a single nutrient. Notice, too, how the new language exonerates the foods themselves. Now, the culprit is an obscure, invisible, tasteless, and politically unconnected substance that may or may not lurk in them called saturated fat. The linguistic capitulation did nothing to rescue McGovern from his blunder. In the very next election, in 1980, the beef lobby succeeded in rusticating the three-term senator, sending an unmistakable warning to anyone who would challenge the American diet, and in particular, the big chunk of animal protein squatting in the middle of its plate. Henceforth, government dietary guidelines would shun plain talk about whole foods, each of which has its trade association on Capitol Hill, but would instead arrive clothed in scientific euphemism and speaking of nutrients, entities that few Americans, including, as we would find out, American nutrition scientists, really understood, but that, with the notable exception of sucrose, lack powerful lobbies in Washington. Sucrose is the exception that proves the rule. Only the power of the sugar lobby in Washington can explain the fact that the official U.S. recommendation for the maximum permissible level of free sugars in the diet is an eye-popping 25% of daily calories. To give you some idea just how permissive that is, the World Health Organization recommends that no more than 10% of daily calories come from added sugars, a benchmark that the U.S. sugar lobby has worked furiously to dismantle. In 2004, it enlisted the Bush State Department in a campaign to get the recommendation changed, and has threatened to lobby Congress to cut WHO funding unless the organization recants. Perhaps we should be grateful that the saturated fat interests have as yet organized no such lobby. The lesson of the McGovern fiasco was quickly absorbed by all who would pronounce on the American diet. When a few years later the National Academy of Sciences looked into the question of diet and cancer, it was careful to frame its recommendations nutrient by nutrient, rather than food by food, so as to avoid offending any powerful interests. We now know the Academy's panel of 13 scientists adopted this approach over the objections of at least two of its members, who argued that most of the available science pointed toward conclusions about foods rather than nutrients. According to T. Colin Campbell, a nutritional biochemist who served on the panel, all of the human population studies linking dietary fat to cancer actually showed that the groups with higher cancer rates consumed not just more fats, but also more animal foods and fewer plant foods as well. This meant that these cancers could just as easily be caused by animal protein, dietary cholesterol, something else exclusively found in animal-based foods, or a lack of plant-based foods, Campbell wrote years later. His argument fell on deaf ears. In the case of the good foods, too, nutrients also carried the day. The language of the final report highlighted the benefits of antioxidants in vegetables rather than the vegetables themselves. Joan Gussow, a Columbia University nutritionist who served on the panel, argued against the focus on nutrients rather than whole foods. The really important message in the epidemiology, which is all we had to go on, was that some vegetables and citrus fruits seemed to be protective against cancer. But those sections of the report were written as though it was the vitamin C in the citrus or the beta-carotene in the vegetables that was responsible for the effect. I kept changing the language to talk about foods that contain vitamin C and foods that contain carotenes. Because how do you know it's not one of the other things in the carrots or the broccoli? There are hundreds of carotenes. But the biochemists had their answer. You can't do a trial on broccoli. So the nutrients won out over the foods. The panel's resort to scientific reductionism had the considerable virtue of being both politically expedient, in the case of meat and dairy, and, to these scientific heirs of Justus von Liebig, intellectually sympathetic. With each of its chapters focused on a single nutrient, the final draft of Diet, Nutrition, and Cancer framed its recommendations in terms of saturated fats and antioxidants rather than beef and broccoli. In doing so, the 1982 National Academy of Sciences report helped codify the official new dietary language, the one we all still speak. Industry and media soon followed suit, and terms like polyunsaturated, cholesterol, monounsaturated, carbohydrate, fiber, polyphenols, amino acids, flavonols, carotenoids, antioxidants, probiotics, and phytochemicals soon colonized much of the cultural space previously occupied by the tangible material formerly known as food. The age of nutritionism had arrived. Nutritionism defined. The term isn't mine. It was coined by an Australian sociologist of science by the name of Jörg Skrinis, and as near as I can determine, first appeared in a 2002 essay titled Sorry Marge, published in an Australian quarterly called Mianjin. Sorry Marge looked at margarine as the ultimate nutritionist product, able to shift its identity. No cholesterol one year, no trans fats the next, depending on the prevailing winds of dietary opinion. But Skrinis had bigger game in his sights than spreadable vegetable oil. He suggested that we look past the various nutritional claims swirling around margarine and butter and consider the underlying message of the debate itself. Namely, that we should understand and engage with food and our bodies in terms of their nutritional and chemical constituents and requirements. The assumption being that this is all we need to understand. This reductionist way of thinking about food had been pointed out and criticized before, notably by the Canadian historian Harvey Levenstein, the British nutritionist Geoffrey Cannon, and the American nutritionists Joan Gussow and Marion Nestle. But it had never before been given a proper name. Nutritionism. Proper names have a way of making visible things we don't easily see or simply take for granted. The first thing to understand about nutritionism is that it is not the same thing as nutrition. As the ism suggests, it is not a scientific subject, but an ideology. Ideologies are ways of organizing large swaths of life and experience under a set of shared but unexamined assumptions. This quality makes an ideology particularly hard to see, at least while it's still exerting its hold on your culture. A reigning ideology is a little like the weather, all-pervasive and so virtually impossible to escape. Still, we can try. In the case of nutritionism, the widely shared but unexamined assumption is that the key to understanding food is indeed the nutrient. Put another way, foods are essentially the sum of their nutrient parts. From this basic premise flow several others. Since nutrients, as compared with foods, are invisible and therefore slightly mysterious, it falls to the scientists, and to the journalists through whom the scientists speak to the public, to explain the hidden reality of foods to us. In form, this is a quasi-religious idea, suggesting the visible world is not the one that really matters, and also, like a religion, it implies the need for a priesthood. For to enter a world where your dietary salvation depends on unseen nutrients, you need plenty of expert help. But expert help to do what, exactly? This brings us to another unexamined assumption of nutritionism, that the whole point of eating is to maintain and promote bodily health. Hippocrates' famous injunction to let food be thy medicine is ritually invoked to support this notion. I'll leave the premise alone for now, except to point out that it is not shared by all cultures, and further, that the experience of these other cultures suggests that, paradoxically, regarding food as being about things other than bodily health, like pleasure, say, or sociality, or identity, makes people no less healthy. Indeed, there's some reason to believe it may make them more healthy. This is what we usually have in mind when we speak of the French paradox. So there is at least a question as to whether the ideology of nutritionism is actually any good for you. It follows from the premise that food is foremost about promoting physical health, that the nutrients in food should be divided into the healthy ones and the unhealthy ones, good nutrients and bad. This has been a hallmark of nutritionist thinking from the days of Liebig, for whom it wasn't enough to identify the nutrients. He also had to pick favorites, and nutritionists have been doing so ever since. Liebig claimed that protein was the master nutrient in animal nutrition because he believed it drove growth. Indeed, he likened the role of protein in animals to that of nitrogen in plants. Protein, which contains nitrogen, comprised the essential human fertilizer. Liebig's elevation of protein dominated nutritionist thinking for decades, as public health authorities worked to expand the access to and production of the master nutrient, especially in the form of animal protein, with the goal of growing bigger and therefore, it was assumed, healthier people. A high priority for Western governments fighting imperial wars. To a considerable extent, we still have a food system organized around the promotion of protein as the master nutrient. It has given us, among other things, vast amounts of cheap meat and milk, which have in turn given us much, much bigger people. Whether they are healthier, too, is another question. It seems to be a rule of nutritionism that for every good nutrient, there must be a bad nutrient to serve as its foil, the latter a focus for our food fears and the former for our enthusiasms. A backlash against protein arose in America at the turn of the last century, as diet gurus like John Harvey Kellogg and Horace Fletcher, about whom, more later, railed against the deleterious effects of protein on digestion. It supposedly led to the proliferation of toxic bacteria in the gut and promoted the cleaner, more wholesome carbohydrate in its place. The legacy of that revaluation is the breakfast cereal, the strategic objective of which was to dethrone animal protein at the morning meal. Ever since, the history of modern nutritionism has been a history of macronutrients at war. Protein against carbs, carbs against proteins, and then fats, fats against carbs. Beginning with Liebig, in each age nutritionism has organized most of its energies around an imperial nutrient. Protein in the 19th century, fat in the 20th, and it stands to reason carbohydrates will occupy our attention in the 21st. Meanwhile, in the shadow of these titanic struggles, smaller civil wars have raged within the sprawling empires of the Big Three. Refined carbohydrates versus fiber, animal protein versus plant protein, saturated fats versus polyunsaturated fats, and then, deep down within the province of the polyunsaturates, omega-3 fatty acids versus omega-6s. Like so many ideologies, nutritionism at bottom hinges on a form of dualism, so that at all times there must be an evil nutrient for adherents to excoriate and a savior nutrient for them to beatify. At the moment, trans fats are performing admirably in the former role, omega-3 fatty acids in the latter. It goes without saying that such a Manichaean view of nutrition is bound to promote food fads and phobias and large abrupt swings of the nutritional pendulum. Another potentially serious weakness of nutritionist ideology is that, focused so relentlessly as it is on the nutrients it can measure, it has trouble discerning qualitative distinctions among foods. So fish, beef, and chicken, through the nutritionist's lens, become mere delivery systems for varying quantities of different fats and proteins and whatever other nutrients happen to be on their scope. Milk, through this lens, is reduced to a suspension of protein, lactose, fats, and calcium in water, when it is entirely possible that the benefits, and for that matter, the hazards of drinking milk, may owe to entirely other factors. Growth hormones? Or relationships between factors, fat-soluble vitamins and saturated fat, that have been overlooked. Milk remains a food of humbling complexity, to judge by the long, sorry saga of efforts to simulate it. The entire history of baby formula has been the history of one overlooked nutrient after another. Liebig missed the vitamins and amino acids, and his successors missed the omega-3s. And still, to this day, babies fed on the most nutritionally complete formula fail by many measures to do as well as babies fed human milk. Even more than margarine, infant formula stands as the ultimate test product of nutritionism and a fair index of its hubris. This brings us to one of the most troubling features of nutritionism, though it is a feature certainly not troubling to all. When the emphasis is on quantifying the nutrients contained in foods, or to be precise, the recognized nutrients in foods, any qualitative distinction between whole foods and processed foods is apt to disappear. If foods are understood only in terms of the various quantities of nutrients they contain, Georg Skrinis wrote, then even processed foods may be considered to be healthier for you than whole foods if they contain the appropriate quantities of some nutrients. How convenient. Nutritionism comes to market. No idea could be more sympathetic to manufacturers of processed foods, which surely explains why they have been so happy to jump on the nutritionism bandwagon. Indeed, nutritionism supplies the ultimate justification for processing food, by implying that with a judicious application of food science, fake foods can be made even more nutritious than the real thing. This, of course, is the story of margarine, the first important synthetic food to slide into our diet. Margarine started out in the 19th century as a cheap and inferior substitute for butter, but with the emergence of the lipid hypothesis in the 1950s, manufacturers quickly figured out that their product, with some tinkering, could be marketed as better, smarter than butter. Butter with the bad nutrients removed, cholesterol and saturated fats, and replaced with good nutrients, polyunsaturated fats, and then vitamins. Every time margarine was found lacking, the wanted nutrient could simply be added. Vitamin D? Got it now. Vitamin A? Sure, no problem. But of course, margarine, being the product not of nature but of human ingenuity, could never be any smarter than the nutritionists dictating its recipe, and the nutritionists turned out to be not nearly as smart as they thought they were. The food scientists' ingenious method for making healthy vegetable oil solid at room temperature, by blasting it with hydrogen, turned out to produce unhealthy trans fats. Fats that we now know are more dangerous than the saturated fats they were designed to replace. Yet the beauty of a processed food like margarine is that it can be endlessly re-engineered to overcome even the most embarrassing about-face in nutritional thinking, including the real wincer that its main ingredient is linked to heart attacks and cancer. So now the trans fats are gone, and margarine marches on, unfazed and apparently unkillable. Too bad the same cannot be said of an unknown number of margarine eaters. By now we have become so inured to fake foods that we forget what a challenging trail margarine had to blaze before it and other synthetic food products could win government and consumer acceptance. At least since the 1906 publication of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, the adulteration of common foods has been a serious concern of the eating public and the target of numerous federal laws and Food and Drug Administration regulations. Many consumers regarded oleomargarine as just such an adulteration, and in the late 1800s, 5 states passed laws requiring that all butter imitations be dyed pink so no one would be fooled. The Supreme Court struck down the laws in 1898. In retrospect, had the practice survived, it might have saved some lives. The 1938 Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act imposed strict rules requiring that the word imitation appear on any food product that was, well, an imitation. Read today, the language of the 1938 legislation seems at once commonsensical and quaint. There are certain traditional foods that everyone knows, such as bread, milk, and cheese, and that when consumers buy these foods, they should get the foods they are expecting. And if a food resembles